beside her until he spoke. "You look scared," Mr. Walker said. "This thing between you and my dad could tear Connick apart," she said. "You know that, right?"
"Trust me, Lenny. There's nothing for you to worry about."
Lenny looked up at Mr. Walker. "You're wrong," she said.
"You worry too much,"
Large Marge said to Lenny the next day when Lenny showed up to work. For the past year, Lenny had worked part-time at the general store, stocking shelves, dusting supplies, ringing up sales on the antique cash register. She made enough money to keep herself well-stocked with film and books. Dad had been against it, of course, but this one time, Mama had stood up to him, told him a 17-year-old girl needed an after-school job. "That vandalism is a bad thing," Lenny said, staring through the window, down the street toward the ruined saloon.
"Aw, men are stupid. You might as well learn that now. Look at Bull Moose. They ram into each other at full speed. Same with Doll Sheep. This will be a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing."
Lenny didn't agree. She saw what her father's vandalism had done, the effects of it on the people around her. A few painted words had become bullets hurtled into the heart of a town. Although the party last night on Main Street had raged as it always did, clattering on until daylight began at last to dim, she had seen how the townspeople divided themselves into teams, one that believed in change and growth and another that didn't. When the party had finally ended, everyone had gone their separate ways. Separate, in a town that used to be about being together. On Sunday night, Lenny and her parents went to the Harlan compound for a barbecue dinner. Afterward, as usual, they built a big bonfire in the mud and stood around it, talking and drinking as evening fell around them, turning the people into violet silhouettes. From her place on Thelma's porch, rereading Matthew's latest letter by lantern light, Lenny could see the adults gathered near the flames. A jug that looked from here like a black wasp moved from hand to hand. She heard the men's voices above the snapping, hissing flames, a din of rising anger.
"Take over our town. Arrogant prick, thinks he owns us. Next he'll want to bring in electricity and television, turn us into Las Vegas."
Headlights spread through the darkness. Dogs went crazy in the yard, barked and howled as a big white truck rumbled through the mud, parked with a splash. Mr. Walker got out of his expensive new truck, strode confidently toward the bonfire, calm as you please, as if he belonged here. Uh-oh. Lenny folded up her letter, jammed it in her pocket, and stepped down into the mud. Dad's face was orange in the firelight. His topknot had fallen, now lay in a lump of hair behind his left ear.
"Looks like someone is lost," he said, his voice pulled out of shape by booze. "You don't belong here, Walker."
"Says the Chichaco,"
Mr. Walker said. His broad smile took some of the sting out of the insult, or maybe it added to it. Lenny wasn't sure.
"I've been here 4 years,
Dad said, his mouth flattening until his lips almost disappeared.
"That long, huh?"
Mr. Walker said, crossing his big arms across his chest.
"I got boots that have covered more ground in Alaska than you have. Now look, down boy,"
Mr. Walker said, grinning, although the smile didn't reach his eyes.
"I'm not here to talk to you. I'm here to talk to them."
He lifted his chin to indicate Clyde and Donna and Thelma and Ted.
"I've known them all of my life. Hell, I taught Clyde how to hunt duck. Remember, Clyde? And Thelma smacked me a good one for getting fresh when we were kids. I came to talk to my friends."
Dad looked uncomfortable, irritated. Mr. Walker smiled at Thelma, who smiled back.
"We drank our first beers together, remember? The Moose is our place, ours. Hell, Donna, you guys got married there."
Donna glanced at her husband, smiled uncertainly.
"Here's the thing. It's time we fix the old girl up. We deserve a place where we can gather and talk and have fun without smelling like burnt wood and having soot all down ourselves when we leave. It will take a lot of work, though.
Mr. Walker paused, his gaze moving from face to face.
And a lot of workers. I can hire people from Homer, pay them the $4 an hour to rebuild the place, but I'd rather keep my money here, in town, with my friends and neighbors. We all know how nice it is to have some change in our jeans come winter.
$4 an hour? That's high,
Ted said, shooting Thelma a look.
I want to be more than fair,
Mr. Walker said.
Huh,
Dad said.
He's trying to manipulate you, buy you. Don't listen to him. We know what's good for our town, and it isn't his money.
Thelma shot Dad an irritated look. How long will the job last, Tom? He shrugged.
Gotta be done before the weather turns, Thelma.
And how many workers do you need?
As many as I can get.
Thelma stepped back, turned to Ted, whispered something to him.
Earl,
Dad said.
You're not going to let him do this.
Mad Earl's pale, wrinkled face squelched up, looked like one of those dried apple carvings.
Jobs is scarce up here, ain't?
Lenny saw the effect those few words had on her father.
I'll take a job,
Clyde said. Mr. Walker smiled triumphantly. Lenny saw his gaze cut to Dad. Stay there.
Great. Anyone else?
When Clyde had come forward, Dad made a sound like a tire blowing and grabbed Mama by the arm and pulled her across the compound. Lenny had to run through the mud to keep up. They all climbed into the truck. Dad hit the gas too hard and the tires spun through the mud before finding traction. He shoved the pickup into reverse, lurched back, and spun around and hurtled through the open gates. Mama reached over and held Lenny's hand. They both knew better than to say anything as he started muttering to himself, thumping his palm hard on the steering wheel to punctuate his thoughts.
Damn idiots, letting him win. Goddamn rich men think they own the world.
At the cabin, he skidded to a stop and rammed the gear shift in park. Lenny and Mama sat there, afraid to breathe too loudly. He didn't move, just stared through the dirty, mosquito-splattered windshield at the shadowy smokehouse and the stand of black trees beyond. The sky was a deep purple-brown, strewn with pinprick stars.
Go,
he said, his teeth gritted.
I need to think.
Lenny opened the door, and she and Mama practically tumbled out of the pickup in their haste to disappear. Hand in hand, they slogged through the mud and climbed the steps and opened the door, slamming it shut behind them, wishing they could lock it, but they knew better. In one of his rages, he might burn the place down to get to Mama. Lenny went to the window, peeled the curtain aside, looked out. The truck was there, puffing into the night, its headlights two bright beams. She could see him in silhouette, talking to himself. He did it. Lenny said, standing close. Vandalized the tavern. No, he was home, in bed with me, and it's not the kind of thing he would do. A part of Lenny wanted to keep this from her mother, to spare her pain, but the truth was burning a hole in Lenny's soul. Sharing it was the only way to put out the flames. They were a team, she and Mama, together. They didn't keep secrets from each other. After you fell asleep, he took the truck to town. I saw him leave with an axe. Mama lit a cigarette, exhaled heavily. I thought for once. Lenny got it. Hope, a shiny thing, a lure for the unwary. She knew how seductive it could be and how dangerous. What do we do? Do? He was already pissed about losing his pipeline job, and now this thing with the saloon, with Tom, could push him over the edge. Lenny felt her mother's fear and the shame that was its silent twin. We are going to have to be very careful. This thing could blow up. 14. April in Fairbanks was an unreliable month. This year, an unseasonable cold gripped the town. Snow fell, the birds stayed away, the rivers stayed frozen. Even the old-timers began to complain, and they had spent decades in this town that was called the coldest in America. Matthew walked away from the ice rink after practice, his hockey stick slung over his shoulders. He knew he looked like an ordinary 17-year-old in a sweat-dampened hockey uniform and boots, but looks could be deceiving. He knew it, and they knew it, the kids he'd gone to school with for the past few years. Oh, they were friendly enough. No one judged anyone this far from civilization. You could be whoever you wanted to be. But they gave him a wide berth. Rumors of his breakdown had spread faster than a wildfire on the Kenai. Before he took his seat in his first class in 9th grade, he'd already had a reputation. High school kids, even in the wilds of Alaska, were still herd animals. They sensed when there was a weak member in their midst. Ice fog, a gray, heavy haze peppered with tiny particles of frozen pollutants, turned Fairbanks into a funhouse version of itself, where nothing was quite solid, no line distinct. The place smelled of trapped exhaust, like a racetrack. The squat, two-story buildings across the street appeared to be holding each other up, forlorn in the fog. Like many of the buildings in town, they looked temporary, hastily built. Through the gloom, people were charcoal drawings, lines and slashes, the homeless who huddled in doorways, the drunks who sometimes stumbled out of taverns late at night and froze to death. Not all of those Matthew saw now would survive the day or the week, let alone this unexpected cold in a town where winter lasted from September through April and night lay across the land for 18 hours. There were casualties every day. People went missing all the time. As he walked to his pickup truck, night fell. Just like that, in a blink. Street lamps created the only light there was, dots here and there, aside from the occasional snake of headlights in the glow. He wore a parka, beneath that his hockey sweater, long underwear, and his hockey pants and mucklucks. It wasn't that cold, not by Fairbanks standards, barely below freezing. He didn't bother with gloves. It didn't take long for the truck to start, not this time of year, not like in the deep midwinter when you left your truck running while you were at the store or running errands, when the thermostat often dropped to 25 below. He climbed into his uncle's big, double-doored pickup and drove through town slowly, alert, always looking for animals or sliding cars or kids playing where they shouldn't be playing. A banged-up Dodge pulled out in front of him. It had a sign in the back window that read, "Warning. In case of rapture, this car will be unmanned." There were a lot of bumper stickers like that out here, deep in Alaska's wild interior, far from the tourist destinations of the coast or the majestic beauty of Denali. Alaska was full of fringists, people who believed in weirdo things and prayed to exclusionary gods and filled their basements with equal measures of guns and Bibles. If you wanted to live in a place where no one told you what to do and didn't care if you parked a trailer in your yard or had a fridge on your porch, Alaska was the state for you. His aunt said it was the romance of adventure that attracted so many individuals. Matthew didn't know if he agreed. Actually, he didn't expend much energy thinking about stuff like that, but he did know that the farther away you got from civilization, the stranger things got. Most people spent one dark, bleak, 8-month winter in Fairbanks and left the state screaming. The few who stayed, misfits, adventurers, romantics, loners, rarely left again. It took him almost 15 minutes to reach the homestead road and 5 more minutes to get to the house he'd called home for the last few years. 2 decades ago, when his mother's family had homesteaded out here, the land had been remote. Over the years, town had crept closer, spread out. Fairbanks might be in the middle of nowhere, fewer than 120 miles from the Arctic Circle, but it was the second largest city in the state and growing fast because of the pipeline. He drove up the long, winding, tree-shrouded driveway and parked in the huge, plank-sided garage/workshop between Uncle Rick's ATV and his snow machine. Inside the house, the walls were roughly hewn planks that looked messy in the combination of light and shadow. His aunt and uncle had always intended to drywall them, but never had. The kitchen was delineated by L-shaped polished wood counters set atop green cabinets that had come from an abandoned house in Anchorage. One of those dream homes built by lowlanders who couldn't last through their first winter. A bar with three bar stools separated it from the dining area. Beyond that was the living room, a big plaid sectional, complete with movable footrests, and two well-worn lazy boy chairs faced a window that overlooked the river. There were bookcases everywhere, overflowing with books. Lanterns and flashlights decorated almost every surface for when the power went out, and it went out often, with so many big trees and bad weather. The house had electricity and running water and even a television, but no flush toilets. Truthfully, no walker ever cared. They'd all been raised without houses and were happy to live that way. People down south had no idea how clean an outhouse could be if you took care of it. "Hey, you," Allie said, looking up from the sofa. She was doing homework by the looks of it. Matthew dropped his gear bag by the door and propped his hockey stick in the Arctic entry, a corridor full of coats and boots that separated the outside from the inside. He hung up his coat on a hook and kicked off his boots. He was so tall now, 6'2", that he had to duck to enter the house.
"Hey."
He plopped down beside her. "You smell like a goat," she said, closing her textbook.
"A goat who scored 2 goals.
He leaned back, laid his head on the sofa back, stared up at the big wood crossbeams that traversed the ceiling. He didn't know why, but he felt nervous, a little raw. He tapped his foot, played an arpeggio on the worn armrest with his fingers. Allie stared at him. As usual, she had applied her makeup sporadically, as if she'd lost interest halfway through the process. Her blonde hair was drawn back into a messy ponytail that hung a little to the left. He had no idea if that was intentional. She was beautiful in the natural, rough-hewn way of Alaskan girls, who were more likely to hunt on the weekends than go to a shopping mall or movie theater.
"You're doing it again," he said.
"What?"
"Watching me, like you think I'm going to explode or something."
"No," she said, trying to smile. "It's just, you know, are you having a bad day?" Matthew closed his eyes, sighed. His older sister had been his salvation. There was no doubt about that. Back when he'd first moved here, when he'd been unable to deal with his grief and been beset by terrible nightmares, Allie had been his steadying hand, the voice that could get through to him. Although it had taken time. For the first 3 months, he pretty much hadn't talked at all. The therapist they sent him to was no help. He'd known from the first session that it wouldn't be a stranger's hand he'd reach out to, especially not one who talked to him as if he were a kid. It was Allie who had saved him. She never gave up, never stopped asking how he felt. When he finally found the words to express himself, his grief had shown itself to be bottomless, terrifying. He still cringed at the way he'd cried. His sister had held him when he cried, rocked him as their mother would have done. Over the years, the two of them had fashioned a vocabulary for grief, learned how to talk about their loss. He and Allie had talked about their pain until there were no words left to say. They'd also spent hours in silence, standing side by side on the river, fly fishing, and hiking rough trails in the Alaska Range. In time, his grief had turned to anger, and then drifted towards sorrow, and now, finally, it had settled into a lingering sadness that was a part of him, not the whole. Lately, they'd begun to talk about the future instead of the past. It was big, that change, and they knew it. Allie had been hiding out in school, using the classroom as a shield against the hard realities of life as a motherless girl, and she'd stayed here in Fairbanks to be at Matthew's side. Before Mom's death, Allie had dreamed big of moving to New York or Chicago, someplace that had bus service and live theater and opera halls. But as with Matthew, loss had rearranged her from the inside out. Now she knew how much family mattered and how important it was to hang on to the people you loved. Lately, she'd begun to talk about moving back onto the homestead with Dad and maybe working with him. Matthew knew that his presence here was holding his sister back. It could go on this way forever if he let it, and a part of him wanted to do just that. But he was almost 18 years old. If he didn't push his way out of the nest, she'd stay next to him forever.
"I want to finish the school year in Conic,"
he said into the silence. He heard the question she didn't ask and answered it.
I can't hide out forever, he said.
Allie looked frightened. She'd seen him through the worst of times, and he knew that she was terrified of him sliding back into depression. But you love hockey, and you're good at it.
The season ends in 2 weeks, and I start college in September.
Lenny. Matthew wasn't surprised that she understood. He and Allie had talked about everything, including Lenny, and how much her letters meant to Matthew.
What if she goes off to college somewhere? I want to see her. I might not get another chance.
Are you sure you're ready? Everywhere you look, you'll see Mom. And there it was, the big question. The truth was, he didn't know if he could handle any of it. Going back to Connick, seeing the river that swallowed his mother, seeing his father's grief in Technicolor up close. But he knew one thing. Lenny's letters had mattered to him. Maybe they'd saved him as much as Allie had. For all their separate miles and their different lives, Lenny's letters and the photographs she sent reminded him of who he'd been.
I see her everywhere here, don't you?
Allie nodded slowly.
I swear I see her out of the corner of my eye all of the time. I talk to her at night.
He nodded. Sometimes in the morning when he woke up, he had a split second where he thought the world was upright, that he was an ordinary kid in an ordinary house, and that his mom would soon be calling him down for breakfast. The silence on mornings like that was awful.
You want me to come with you?
He did. He wanted her beside him, holding his hand, keeping him steady.
No, you don't get out of school until June,
he said, hearing the unsteadiness in his voice, knowing she heard it too.
Besides, I think I have to do this by myself.
You know Dad loves you. He'll be thrilled to have you back.
He did know that. He also knew that love could freeze over, become a kind of thin ice all its own. He and Dad had had a tough time talking in the past few years. Grief and guilt had bent them out of shape. Allie reached out for him, took his hand in hers. He waited for her to speak, but she didn't say anything. They both knew why. There was nothing to say. Sometimes you had to go backward in order to go forward. This truth they knew, even as young as they were. But there was another truth, one they shied away from, one they tried to protect each other from. Sometimes it was painful to go back. Maybe grief had been waiting for Matthew to return all this time, waiting in the dark, in the cold. Maybe in Connick he'd undo all this progress and break down again.
You're stronger now, Allie said.
I guess we'll find out.
2 weeks later, Matthew flew his uncle's float plane over Otter Point and banked right, lowered, touched down on the flat blue water below. He killed the engine and floated toward the big silvered wood arch that read Walker Cove. His father stood at the end of the dock, his arms at his sides. Matthew jumped off the pontoon and onto the dock and tied the float plane down. He remained that way, bent over, his back to his father for a moment longer than necessary, gathering the strength he needed to really be here. At last he straightened, turned. His father was close now. He pulled Matthew into a bone-jarring hug that went on so long Matthew had to gasp for breath. Dad drew back finally, looked at him, and love took shape in the air around them, a regret and memory-filled version maybe, sad around the edges, but love. It had been only a few months since they'd seen each other. Dad made it a point to come to several of Matthew's hockey games and visit in Fairbanks as often as the harsh weather and homesteading chores allowed, but they had never really talked about anything that mattered. Dad seemed older, his skin more lined and creased. He smiled in that way of his, the way he did everything in life, full tilt, no explanations, no regret, no safety nets. You knew Tom Walker in a glance, because he let you in. You knew instantly that this was a man who always told the truth as he saw it, whether it was popular or not, who had a set of rules to guide his life and no other rules that mattered. He laughed harder than any man Matthew had ever met, and Matthew had only seen him cry once, on that day out on the ice.
You're even taller than the last time I saw you. I'm like the Hulk. I keep tearing through my clothes.
Dad grabbed Matthew's suitcase and led him up the dock, past the fishing boat straining at its lines. Seabirds cawed overhead, waves slapped the pilings. The smell of kelp baking in the sun and eelgrass beaten down by waves greeted them. At the top of the stairs, Matthew got his first glimpse of the big log home with the soaring bowed front and wraparound porch. A welcoming light illuminated the pots hanging from the eaves, still full of last year's dead geraniums. Mom's pots. He paused, caught his breath. He hadn't realized how time could unspool the years of your life until for a second you were 14 again, crying from a place so deep it seemed to predate you, desperate to be whole again. Dad went on ahead. Matthew forced himself to move. He passed by the weather-grayed picnic table and climbed the wooden steps to the purple-painted front door. Beside it hung a metal cutout of an orca that read, "Whalecome." That had been a gift from Matthew. It always cracked his mother up. It brought tears to his eyes. He wiped them away, embarrassed by the display in front of his stoic father, and went inside. The house looked the same as it always had, a cluster of reclaimed and antique furniture in the living room, an old picnic table draped in bright yellow fabric with a vase of blue flowers placed in its center. A collection of candles stood like a medieval village around the flowers. His mother's touch was everywhere. He could almost hear her. The interior of the house, bark-darkened log walls, windows large enough to capture the view, a pair of brown leather couches, a piano Grandma had had shipped in from the outside. He walked over to the window, stared out, saw the cove and the dock through a watery image of his own face. He felt his father come up behind him.
Welcome home.
Home. The word had layers of meaning, a place, an emotion, memories.
She was out ahead of me,
he said, hearing the unsteadiness of his voice. He heard the way his father drew in a sharp breath. Would he stop Matthew, abort this conversation they'd never dared to have? There was a moment, a pause that lasted less time than an indrawn breath. Then Dad laid a heavy hand on Matthew's shoulder.
No one could contain your mother,
he said quietly.
It wasn't your fault.
Matthew didn't know how to respond. There was so much to say, but they'd never talked about any of it. How could you even start a conversation like that? Dad pulled Matthew into a fierce embrace.
I'm glad as hell you're back.
Yeah, Matthew said hoarsely.
Me too.
Mid-April, dawn washed across the land well before 7 a.m. When Lenny first opened her eyes, even though it was to darkness, she felt the buoyancy that came with the changing of the seasons. As an Alaskan, she could feel the nascent light, see it in the lessening of the inky black to a charcoal hue. It carried with it a sense of hope, of daylight coming, of everything would be better now, of he would be better. But none of that was true this spring. Even as sunlight was returning, her dad was getting worse, angry and intense, more jealous of Tom Walker. Lenny had a terrible, building feeling that something bad was going to happen. All day at school, she battled a headache. On her bike ride home, she started getting a stomach ache. She tried to tell herself it was her period, but she knew better. It was stress, worry. She and Mama had gone into alert mode again. They made eye contact constantly, walked carefully, tried to be invisible. She rode expertly over the bumpy driveway, taking care to stay on the high ground between the two muddy tire ruts. In her yard, a morass of mud and running water, she saw that the red truck was gone, which meant that Dad was either hunting or had gone to see the Harlins. She slanted her bike against the cabin and did her chores, feeding the animals, checking their water, bringing in the dry sheets from the line, dropping them into a willow basket. Holding the laundry basket on her hip, she heard the high, rubber band sound of a boat engine and stared out at the water, tenting a hand across her eyes. high tide. An aluminum skiff turned into their cove. The putt-putt-putt of the engine was the only sound for miles. Lenny tossed the laundry basket onto the porch and headed for the beach stairs, which they'd strengthened over the years. Almost all of the boards were new. Only here and there could you see the tarnished gray of the original stairs. She descended the zigzag steps in her muddy boots. The boat puttered forward, its sharp prow angled up proudly on the waves. A man stood at the console, guided the boat forward, beached it. Matthew. He killed the engine and stepped out into the ankle-deep water, held on to the boat's ragged white line. She touched her hair in embarrassment. She hadn't bothered to braid it or brush it this morning, and she was wearing the exact same outfit she'd worn to school today and the day before. Her flannel shirt probably smelled like wood smoke. Oh, God. He pulled the boat up onto the beach, dropped the rope, and walked toward her. For years, she'd imagined this moment. In her musings, she always knew exactly what to say. In the privacy of her imagination, they just started talking, picked up the thread of their friendship as if he'd never been gone. But in her mind, he was Matthew, the 14-year-old kid who'd showed her frog's eggs and baby eagles, the boy who'd written her every week. "Dear Lenny, it's hard at this school. I don't think anyone likes me." And to whom she'd written back, "I know a lot about being the new kid in school. It blows. Let me give you a few tips." This man was someone else, someone she didn't know. Tall, long blonde hair, incredibly good-looking. What could she say to this Matthew? He reached into his backpack, pulled out the worn, banged-up, yellowed version of the Lord of the Rings that Lenny had sent him for his 15th birthday. She remembered the inscription she'd written in it, "Friends forever, like Sam and Frodo." A different girl had written that, one who hadn't known the ugly truth about her toxic family. "Like Sam and Frodo," he said. "Sam and Frodo," Lenny repeated after him. Lenny knew it was crazy, but it seemed to her as if they were having a conversation without saying anything, talking about books and durable friendships and overcoming insurmountable odds. Maybe they weren't talking about Sam and Frodo at all. Maybe they were talking about themselves and how they had somehow grown up and stayed kids at the same time. He pulled a small, wrapped box out of his backpack and handed it to her.
"This is for you."
"A present? It's not my birthday." Lenny noticed that her hands were shaking as she tore open the paper. Inside, she found a heavy black Canon Canonet camera in a leather case. She looked up at him in surprise.
"I missed you," he said.
"I missed you too," she said quietly, knowing even as she said it that things had changed. They weren't 14 anymore. More important, her father had changed. Being friends with Tom Walker's son would cause trouble. It worried her that she didn't care. At school the next day, Lenny could hardly concentrate. She kept glancing sideways at Matthew, as if to assure herself that he was really there. Ms. Rhodes had to yell at Lenny several times to get her attention. At the end of class, they walked out of the schoolhouse together, emerged side by side into the sunshine, and walked down the wooden steps and into the muddy ground.
"I'll come back for my ATV,"
he said when she pulled her bike away from its place along the chain-link fence that had been built 2 years ago after a sow and her cubs walked right up to the school door looking for food.
"I'll walk you home, if that's okay."
Lenny nodded. Her voice seemed inaccessible. She hadn't said two words to him all day. She was afraid of embarrassing herself. They weren't children anymore, and she had no idea how to talk to a boy her own age, especially one whose opinion of her mattered so much. She had a solid hold on her plastic handlebar grips, with her dump-recycled bicycle clanging along the gravel road beside her. She said something about her job at the general store, just to break the quiet. She was aware of him physically in a way she'd never experienced before. His height, the breadth of his shoulders, the sure, easy way he walked. She smelled spearmint gum on his breath, and the complex scents of store-bought shampoo and soap on his hair and skin. She was attuned to him, connected in that weird way of predator and prey, a sudden, dangerous, circle of life type of connection that made no sense to her. They turned off Alpine Street and walked into town.
Town sure has changed, Matthew said.
At the saloon, he stopped, tented his hand over his eyes, read the graffiti spray-painted across the charred wooden front.
Some people don't want change, I guess.
Guess not. He looked down at her.
My dad said your dad vandalized the saloon.
Lenny stared up at him, felt shame twist her gut. She wanted to lie to him, but she couldn't. Neither could she say the disloyal words out loud. People assumed her dad had vandalized the saloon. Only she and her mother knew it for sure. Matthew started walking again. Relieved to be past the evidence of her father's anger, she fell into step beside him. When they passed the general store, Large Marge emerged with a bellow, her big arms flung out. She gave Matthew a hug, then thumped him on the back. When she stepped back, she gazed at the two of them.
Be careful, you two. Things aren't good between your dads.
Lenny started off. Matthew followed her. She wanted to smile, but the vandalized tavern and Large Marge's warning had taken the shine off the day. Large Marge was right. Lenny was playing with fire right now. Her dad could drive up this road at any minute. It would not be good for him to see her walking home with Matthew Walker. Lenny? She realized Matthew had run to catch up with her. Sorry.
Sorry for what?
Lenny didn't know how to answer. She was sorry for things he knew nothing about, for a future she was probably dragging him into that would surely sour. Instead, she said some lame thing about the latest book she'd read. For the remainder of the way home, they talked about superficial things, the weather, the movies he'd seen in Fairbanks, the latest lures for King Salmon. It seemed that no time had passed, even though they had walked together for almost an hour, when Lenny saw the metal gate with the cow skull on it up ahead. Mr. Walker was standing beside a big yellow excavator that was parked beside the gate that marked the entrance to his land. Lenny came to a stop. What's your dad doing?
He's clearing some acreage to build cabins, and he's putting up an arch over the driveway so guests will know how to find us. He's calling it the Walker Cove Adventure Lodge, or something like that.
A lodge for tourists? Right here? Lenny felt Matthew's gaze on her face as strongly as any touch.
You bet. There's money to be made.
Mr. Walker walked toward them, pulling the trucker's cap off his head, revealing a white strip of skin along his forehead, scratching his damp hair.
My dad won't like that arch, Lenny said as he approached.
Your dad doesn't like much,
Mr. Walker said with a smile, mopping the sweat from his brow with a bunched-up bandana.
And you being friends with my Maddie is going to be at the top of his hate list. You know that, right?
Yeah, Lenny said.
Come on, Lenny,
Matthew said. He took her by the elbow and led her away from his father, with the bicycle clattering alongside. When they came to Lenny's driveway, she stopped, stared down the tree-shaded road.
You should leave now, she said, pulling away.
I want to walk you home.
No, she said.
Your dad?
She wished the world would just open up and swallow her. She nodded.
He would not want me to be friends with you.
Screw him, Matthew said. He can't tell us we can't be friends. No one can. Dad told me about the stupid feud going on. Who cares? What's it to us?
But
do you like me, Lenny? Do you want to be friends?
She nodded. The moment felt solemn, serious, a pact being made.
And I like you. So there, it's done. We're friends. There's nothing anyone can do about it.
Lenny knew how naive he was, how wrong. Matthew knew nothing about angry, irrational parents, about punches that broke noses, and the kind of rage that began with vandalism and might go places he couldn't imagine.
My dad is unpredictable,
Lenny said. It was the only equivocal word she could come up with.
What does that mean?
He might hurt you if he found out we liked each other.
I could take on your dad.
Lenny felt a little burst of hysterical laughter rise up.
The idea of Matthew taking on Dad was too terrible to contemplate. She should walk away right now. Tell Matthew they couldn't be friends.
Lenny?
The look in his eyes was her undoing. Had anyone ever looked at her like that? She felt a shiver of something, longing maybe, or relief, or even desire. She didn't know. She just knew she couldn't turn away from it, not after so many lonely years, even though she felt danger slip silently into the water and swim toward her. We can't let my dad know we're friends. Not at all. Not ever.
Sure,
Matthew said, but she could see that he didn't understand. Maybe he knew about pain and loss and suffering. That knowledge of darkness was in his eyes, but he didn't know about fear. He thought her warnings were melodramatic. I mean it, Matthew. He can never know. 15. Lenny dreamed it was raining. She stood on a riverbank, getting drenched. Rain slicked her hair, blurred her vision. The river rose, made a great cracking, thunderous sound, and suddenly it was breakup. House-sized chunks of ice broke free of the land, careening downstream, taking everything in their path, trees, boats, houses. You need to cross. Lenny didn't know if she heard the words or if she'd said them. All she knew was that she needed to cross this river before the ice swept her away and the water rushed into her lungs. But there was nowhere to cross. Ice-cold waves arched up into walls, ground fell away, and trees crashed. Someone screamed. It was her. The river hit her like a shovel to the head, knocked her sideways. She flailed, screamed, felt herself falling, falling. Over here, a voice yelled. Matthew. He could save her. She gasped, tried to claw her way to the surface, but something had a hold of her feet, dragged her down, down, until she couldn't breathe. Everything went dark. Lenny woke with a gasp and saw that she was safe in her room with her stacks of books and the notebooks full of her pictures along the wall and the box full of Matthew's letters beside her. Bad dream. Already fading from memory. Something about a river, she thought. Spring breakup. Another way to die in Alaska. She dressed for school in denim overalls and a plaid flannel shirt. She pulled the hair back from her face and wove it into a loose French braid. Without any mirrors in the house, Dad had broken them all over the years, she couldn't assess how she looked. Lenny had gotten used to seeing herself in shards of glass, herself in pieces. She hadn't cared at all until Matthew's return. Downstairs, she dropped the stack of her school books on the kitchen table and took a seat. Mama set a plate of reindeer sausage, biscuits, and gravy in front of her, alongside a bowl full of blueberries they'd picked from the sandy bluffs above Kachemak Bay last fall. While Lenny ate her breakfast, Mama stood nearby watching her.
You carted water for an hour last night so you could take a bath, and you've braided your hair. It looks beautiful, by the way.
It's called ordinary hygiene, Mama.
I heard Matthew Walker is back in town.
Lenny should have known Mama would put two and two together. Sometimes, because of Dad and all, Lenny forgot how smart Mama was, how perceptive. Lenny kept eating, careful not to make eye contact. She knew what Mama would say about this, so Lenny wasn't going to tell her. Alaska was a big place. There were plenty of places to hide something as small as a friendship.
Too bad your dad hates his dad so much, and too bad your dad has a temper problem. Is that what we're calling it?
Lenny felt Mama eyeing her, like an eagle watching waves for a splash of silver. It was the first time Lenny had hidden something from her mother, and it felt uncomfortable.
You're almost 18, a young woman, and you and Matthew must have written each other 100 letters over the years. What does that have to do with anything? Hormones are like afterburners. The right touch and you're in outer space.
Huh?
I'm talking about love, Lenora. Passion.
Love? Jeez Louise, I don't know why you'd bring that up. There's nothing to worry about, Mama.
Good. You stay smart, baby girl. Don't make the same mistake I did.
Lenny finally looked up.
What mistake?
Dad? Or me? Are you... The door opened and in walked her father, who had washed his hair this morning and put on relatively clean brown canvas pants and a t-shirt. He kicked the door shut behind him, said,
Something smells good, Cora. Morning, Red. Did you sleep well?
Sure, Dad, she said. He kissed the top of her head.
You ready for school? I'll drive you.
I can ride my bike.
Can't I take my second best girl out on a sunny day?
Sure, she said. She picked up her books and lunchbox, still the Winnie the Pooh, she loved it now, and got to her feet.
You be careful at school, Mama said.
Lenny didn't glance back. She followed Dad out to the truck and climbed in. He popped an 8-track tape into the stereo and cranked up the sound. Lion Eyes blared through the speakers. Dad started singing along, going strong, saying,
Sing with me,
as he turned out onto the main road and rumbled toward town. Suddenly, he slammed on the brakes.
Son of a bitch!
Lenny was thrown forward.
Son of a bitch!
Dad said again. Mr. Walker stood beneath the rough timbered arch he'd erected over his driveway. Hand carved into the top beam were the words, Walker Cove Adventure Lodge. Dad jammed the truck in park and got out, striding across the bumpy road, not even trying to avoid the muddy potholes. Mr. Walker saw him coming and stopped work, shoved his hammer through his belt so that it hung from the leather like a weapon. Lenny leaned forward, peered intently through the dirt and squished mosquito-filled windshield. Dad was screaming at Mr. Walker, who smiled and crossed his arms. Lenny was put in mind of a Jack Russell Terrier straining aggressively at the end of his leash, yapping at a Rottweiler. Dad was still yelling when Mr. Walker turned his back and walked to the arch and returned to his work. Dad stood there a minute. Finally, he stalked back to the truck, climbed in, slammed the door shut. He rammed the truck into gear and hit the gas.
Someone needs to knock that son of a bitch down a peg. I knew guys like him in Nam. Shitty, cowardly officers who got better men killed and got medals for it.
Lenny knew better than to say anything. All the way to school, he muttered under his breath, Son of a bitch, arrogant prick, thinks he's better. Lenny knew he would head straight to the compound from here, to find people to join in his bitching, or maybe talk wouldn't be enough anymore. He stopped at the school.
I'm taking the ferry into Homer today. I'll pick you up from work at 5.
Okay. Lenny gathered her books and lunchbox and climbed out of the truck. On her way to the schoolhouse, she didn't look back, and Dad didn't honk in goodbye. He drove away so fast, gravel sputtered out from his tires. She came into the classroom, saw everyone was already seated. Ms. Rhodes was at the blackboard, writing, Iambic pentameter in Shakespeare. Matthew turned in his chair to face her. His smile was like the gravitational pull from one of her science fiction novels. She moved toward him, sat down. He stared at her. Was it the way Dad stared at Mama? She thought so. Sometimes. It made her feel unsettled, kind of anxious. He ripped off a piece of notebook paper and scrawled a note, which he passed to her. It read, Wanna skip work after school? We could do something. Say no, she thought. What she said was, My dad is picking me up at 5.
So that's yes?
She couldn't help smiling.
Yeah.
Cool.
For the rest of the day, Lenny felt both nervous and energized. She could hardly sit still, found it difficult to answer questions about Hamlet. Still, she read her passages aloud and made notes and tried not to reveal to Matthew or anyone else how weird she felt. When school ended, she was the first one out of her chair. She bolted out of the school and ran for the general store, pushed through the narrow door, and yelled, Large Marge! Large Marge was unpacking a case of toilet paper. Like all of her supplies, she purchased it in Soldotna, marked it up, and shelved it for sale.
What's up, kiddo?
I can't work today.
Oh, okay.
Don't you want to know why?
Large Marge smiled, straightened, placed a hand at the small of her back, as if it hurt her to bend over.
Nope.
The bell clanged again. Matthew walked into the store.
Like I said,
Large Marge said,
I don't want to know.
She turned her back on Lenny and Matthew and walked down the crowded aisle, disappearing behind a stack of crab pots.
"Let's go," Matthew said. "Follow me."
They slipped out of the store and hurried past the workers at the Kicking Moose Saloon and up the hill by the Russian Orthodox Church. There they were hidden from view. They hiked out to the point and found a clearing where the blue waters of Kachemak Bay spread out in front of them. At least a dozen small boats were out on the water. Matthew took the big serrated knife from the sheath at his belt and hacked down a bunch of evergreen branches. He laid them on the ground, creating a bower of fragrant green.
"Here, sit."
Lenny sat down. The greenery was buoyant beneath her, springy. He sat down beside Lenny, wishboned his arms to cradle his head in his hands, and lay back.
"Look up."
She looked up.
"No, lie down."
Lenny followed his lead. Above them, white clouds drifted across a pale blue sky.
"You see the poodle?"
Lenny saw the sculpted cloud shape that looked like a groomed poodle.
"That one looks like a pirate ship."
She watched clouds move slowly across the sky, change shapes, become something new before her eyes. She wished change were so easy for people.
"How was Fairbanks?"
"Crowded. For me, anyway. I guess I like the empty and the quiet. And it was rough, full of pipeline workers who drank a lot and started fights. But my aunt and uncle were great, and it was cool to be with Allie. She worried about me a lot."
"So did I."
"Yeah, I know. And I wanted to say I'm sorry,"
he said.
"What for?"
"That day on the field trip when I shoved you, I thought... I was holding it together. I mean, I wasn't, but I thought I was."
"I understood," she said.
"How could you?"
"My dad has nightmares from the war. It makes him crazy sometimes."
"I saw her, my mom, under the ice, floating beneath my feet. Her hair was all splayed out. She was clawing for a way out. And then she was gone."
He let out a ragged breath. She felt him leave her behind, journey into the landscape of dark, thorny memories. Then she felt him come back.
"I don't know if I would have made it without my sister and your letters. I know that sounds weird, but it's true."
At his words, Lenny felt as if the ground beneath her had fallen away, just like in her dream. She knew things now she hadn't known at 14, about ice and loss and even fear. She couldn't imagine losing her mother in any way, but that, watching her under the ice, unable to save her? She turned her head, stared at his profile. The sharp line of his nose, the shadow of a shaven blonde beard, the ridge of his lips. She saw the tiny scar that bisected his eyebrow and the brown mole that peeked out from his hairline.
"You are lucky to have a sister like Alyeska."
"Yeah. She used to want to work for Vogue or something. Now she wants to come back to the homestead and work with Dad. They're going to build an adventure lodge on the property, so another generation of walkers can live in the same place."
He laughed at the idea.
"You don't like that?"
"I do," he said quietly. "I want to teach my kids the things my dad taught me."
Lenny drew away from him at that. That was the last thing in the world she wanted. She turned her attention to the sky again, at the poodle that had become a spaceship.
"I read this cool book, Childhood's End, about the last man alive on Earth. I wonder how that would feel, or to be clairvoyant."
When he reached for her hand, she didn't draw away. Holding his hand, touching him, seemed like the most natural thing in the world. It didn't take Lenny long to know that she was in trouble. She thought about Matthew constantly. At school, she began to study his every move. She watched him as she would a prey animal, trying to glean intent from action. His hand sometimes brushed hers beneath the desk, or he touched her shoulder as he passed by her in the classroom. She didn't know if those brief contacts were intentional or meaningful, but her body responded instinctively to each fleeting touch. Once she'd even risen from her chair, pushed her shoulder into his palm like a cat seeking attention. It wasn't a thought, that lifting up, that unknown need. It just happened. And sometimes, when he talked to her, she thought he stared at her lips the way she stared at his. She found herself secretly mapping his face, memorizing every ridge and hollow and valley as if she were an explorer and he her discovery. She couldn't stop thinking about him, not at school while she was supposed to be reading or at home when she was supposed to be working. She'd lost track of the amount of times Mama had had to raise her voice to get Lenny's attention. She might have talked to Mama, asked her about this edgy restlessness she felt, the dreams of touching and kissing that left her feeling unsettled when she woke, needful of something she couldn't name, but Dad was obviously getting worse, and the cabin felt charged with bad energy. Mama didn't need more to worry about, so Lenny kept her weird, inexplicable longings to herself and tried to make sense of them alone. Now Lenny and her mother and Thelma were out at the stainless steel table at the Harlan compound, gutting fish, slicing the meat into strips. They would soak the strips for days in marinade, then smoke them in the smokehouse for at least 36 hours. Ted was repairing one of the doghouses, while Clyde worked a cowhide, preparing to make it into ropes of rawhide. Off to the left, 13-year-old Agnes was practicing throwing sharp silver stars into trees. Thunk, thunk, thunk. Martha was whittling wood to make a slingshot. Donna was over at the clothesline, pinning up sheets. Dad and Mad Earl had gone into Homer. Thelma threw a bucket of sudsy water over the table, sent the fish innards sliding to the muddy ground where the dogs fought over them. Seated in a plastic chair, with Moppet on the ground beside her, chattering away about some bird's nest she'd found, Lenny worked at repairing a crab pot. There was an uneasiness in camp now. Ever since Mr. Walker had shown up at the compound and reminded the Harlans that his place in their lives had been secured long ago and offered well-paying jobs, Lenny had seen the way the adults looked at one another. Or, to be more precise, didn't look at one another. A schism had opened, not only in town, but also here at the Harlan compound. Lenny wasn't sure who was on what side, but the adults knew. She was pretty sure Dad hadn't spoken to Thelma or Ted since that night. A horn honked loudly enough to startle Lenny. She dropped the crab pot, which landed hard on her ankle. She yelped and kicked it aside. Dad's truck rolled in and parked by the tool shed. Both doors opened at once. Dad and Mad Earl exited the pickup. Dad reached into the back, grabbed a big cardboard box, hefted it into his arms. The box rattled and clanged as Dad carried it into the compound. He went to the high ground by the beehives and looked out at the people. Mad Earl stepped up and stood beside him. The old man looked tired, or more tired than usual. He'd lost most of his hair in the past year, and the lines in his forehead looked like they'd been etched in place. White hair sprouted from his jaw, his cheeks, his nose, his ears.
"Gather around,"
Mad Earl said, gesturing. Thelma wiped her hands on her dirty pant leg and joined her husband. Lenny sidled up to Mama.
"They look drunk," she said.
Mama nodded, lit a cigarette. They walked forward, stood beside Thelma. Standing on the ridge above them like some high priest, Dad smiled down at the people gathered before him. Lenny recognized his big idea smile. She'd seen it lots of times. A beginning. He loved them. Dad placed a hand on Earl's shoulder, gave it a meaningful squeeze.
"Earl here has welcomed me and my family into this safe, wonderful place you've created. We almost feel like Harlans. That's how warm you've all been. I know how much Thelma's friendship means to Cora. Honestly, we have never felt that we belonged anywhere until now."
He put the box down with a rattling clank, pushed it aside with the blunt toe of his rubber boot.
"Beau wanted me to have this cabin. Why? So I could bring what I know to this family. He wanted someone here he could trust to protect his family. As you all know, I have taken that responsibility seriously. Each of you is a crack shot. You are also adept with a bow and arrow. Your bug-out bags are packed and ready to go at a moment's notice. We are ready for martial law or nuclear war or a pandemic. Or so I thought."
Lenny saw Thelma frown.
What do you mean?
Clyde asked, uncrossing his beefy arms.
Last week, an enemy walked through these gates as easy as you please. No one stopped him. Nothing stopped him. He came in here and used words and bribes to put a wedge between us. You know it's true. You feel the dissension. It's all because of Tom Walker.
Thelma muttered, here we go.
Ernst, Ted said. It's just a job. We need the money.
Dad raised his hands, smiling. Lenny knew that smile. It was not a sign of happiness.
I am not blaming anyone. I understand. I'm just pointing out a danger you've missed. When TSHTF, our neighbors will all have sob stories to tell. They'll want what we have, and you'll want to give it to them. You've known them a long time, I get it. So, I'm here to protect you from yourselves, too. Bo would have wanted that,
Mad Earl said. He rolled a cigarette and lit it up, taking a drag so deep Lenny thought he might die on the spot.
Tell him,
Mad Earl said, finally exhaling. Dad squatted down, opened the cardboard flaps of the box, and reached in. He then got back to his feet, holding a plank of wood that had been studded with hundreds of nails, hammered in close to each other to make what looked like a weapon. In his other hand, he held a hand grenade.
No one is ever going to just walk into this place again. First, we're going to build a wall and put razor wire on top. Then, we'll dig a ditch around the perimeter in the places where attackers will come in. We'll fill it with these nail beds, broken glass, spikes, anything we can think of.
Thelma laughed.
This ain't no joke, Missy,
Mad Earl said.
You put the grenade in a mason jar,
Dad said, beaming at his cleverness.
We remove the pin, put the grenade in the jar, and compress the safety lever. Then we bury it. When someone steps on it, the jar breaks and kablooey.
No one spoke. They just stood there, dogs barking in the background. Mad Earl clapped Dad on the back.
Hell of an idea, Ernst. Hell of an idea.
No, Thelma said. And then, no, no. With Mad Earl's cackle going full volume, it took a moment for Thelma's quieter voice to be heard. She pushed her way to the front, then took another step until she was standing alone, the point of the arrow. No, she said again.
No,
her father said, his toothless mouth squelching up. He's off his rocker, Dad, Thelma said. We have children here, and let's face it, more than a few drinkers. We can't booby-trap the perimeter of our home with buried explosives. We'll kill one of us, most likely.
Your job isn't security, Thelma,
Dad said.
It's mine.
No, Ernst. My job is keeping my family safe. I'll go along with stockpiling food and creating water filtration. I'll teach my daughter useful skills like shooting and hunting and trapping. I'll even let you and my dad yammer on about nuclear war and pandemics, but I am not going to worry every day of my life that we could accidentally kill someone for no reason.
Yammer on,
Dad said, his voice going low. Everyone started talking at once, arguing. Lenny felt the schism between them rip free, crack wide open. They separated into two groups, those who wanted to be a family, most of them, versus those who wanted to be able to kill anyone who came close, Dad and Mad Earl and Clyde. We've got kids here, Thelma said. You have to remember that. We can't have bombs or booby traps.
But they could just walk in here with machine guns,
Dad said, looking for support.
Kill us and take what we have.
Lenny heard Moppet say, Could they, Mom? Could they? The argument re-erupted. The adults clotted together, went toe-to-toe, voices raised, faces red.
Enough,
Mad Earl finally said, raising his skeletal hands in the air.